This is The Conversation. I am Michael Shaw. Hello. Before we get to the Anna Sue Hoy episode, I wanted to tell you about a couple things. First of all, we just had a Kickstarter finish recently, finished on the 20th of April. And a Kickstarter, for those of you who don't know, is an online crowdfunding campaign. I used it to raise funds for the next phase of the podcast, and in fact, it was successful. So I want to take this time to thank so much all the artists, past guests who contributed various items to be pledged for. As well, of course, I want to thank everyone who pledged, donated, some of whom got great objects in the process, others who donated just to donate without any reward, and some even contributed a piece and then donated as well. So thank you so much again to all of you. I had some suspicions, I have to admit, about Kickstarter, but in fact, it was a heartwarming experience in many ways. And I just listened, by the way, to a guy named Roman Mars, who is the host of a small public radio show, also a podcast called 99% Invisible. He was talking about doing a Kickstarter for the third season of his show, and he had some interesting and encouraging things to say about this approach, that is Kickstarter and crowdfunding, as a business model. So that's important to keep in mind for the future of this show. We may do it again at the end of season one of The Conversation Three-Way, and that's the next phase I wanted to tell you about. The Conversation Three-Way is coming very soon, and I want to let you know that, speaking of crowdsourcing, we will be using that crowdsourcing approach in order to come up with some of the topics for that format. So please keep that in mind, and if you haven't already, please do become a fan of the show on Facebook. Just find The Conversation, an artist podcast, the longer former title of this show, and you will be able to weigh in on topic suggestions when the calls go out, which will hopefully be on a weekly basis. We have a sponsor this week. Our sponsor is Made with Color, which is a DIY website builder for creative professionals. The Conversation podcast site was built with it. It's really easy to use, and Made with Color has a special discount code for the Conversation podcast listeners. It is Conversation, all lowercase letters. The discount code is good for 29% off the first year of your membership. So whether you're a grad student or mid-career artist or anything else, Made with Color can help you launch a professional-looking website, and it's as easy as updating your Facebook status. Go ahead and visit madewithcolor.com to get your site started today. Okay. Before we get finally to our conversation with Anna, I wanted to thank Paul Soto at Various Small Fires for his warm and generous hosting. And of course, thanks to Anna for allowing me into her email communique and for being a good sport through this process. Final heads up, there's a bit of an abrupt edit at 18:12 in this recording. There was a lovely dog on the premises of our recording, and he was a little more interested in his toy than our podcast. There's a learning curve for dogs as well. So on to the show. Thank you for listening, and I will talk to you soon.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm gonna try to pronounce your name because I think I got Anna right.
You got Anna.
So
is right.
Anna Sohoy?
It's Anna Sue Hoy.
Sue Hoy. Okay, got it. So what is the story with Hoy? What kind of name is that?
Well, my whole last name is Sue Hoy, and the name has been around since the 1860s, but it is the result of a mistake in translation. So, because Chinese names, the family name is first, like the surname is first, and then the given name is after.
Right.
And then in the 1860s, the person that I'm descended from came to New Zealand, which is a Commonwealth country, to participate in the gold rush. And when he came from China, and when he got to New Zealand, They said, "What's your name?" He said, "Choi Soo-hoi." And they said, "Okay, you're Charlie Soo-hoi." And so his name, which before his family name was Choi, suddenly a new family name was created, which is Soo-hoi. So actually in New Zealand, Soo-hoi is a big name because he ultimately invented a new way to dredge the gold, the tiny pieces of gold from the streams. And so by being able to collect the tiny, tiny little pieces of gold and letting it add up to something, he became rich and brought a lot of people over. So then suddenly the New Zealand was full of Soo-hois. So that's my name.
Well, he had a lot of descendants.
Yeah. He brought lots of people over, and then they were all in New Zealand, and then they also made lots of more descendant people.
Oh, okay. But what was entailed in him bringing people over? He was like, "Here's an opportunity."
Yeah. Well, yes, I assume.
Well, the Hoy is H-O-Y.
Yeah.
Is that the original spelling as well?
Well, the thing is, you can't spell Chinese with the Roman alphabet, so I don't know what the original it's not the original spelling.
It just seems so Spanish, and I would imagine, you know, that
I see.
Even with the
like
Roman
boy, like today,
well, even with the Roman spelling, you would think that it would be H-O-I. So I don't know, is this getting too detailed, people?
I think it's like every translation from one to another language is wrong, you know. There's no right. I mean, you can argue that it's wrong,
right? Well, it does bring up the point that you're Kiwi.
Yes.
How long does one have to be in New Zealand to sort of claim that as there?
Well, I wonder if any people living in New Zealand who spent a long time there would consider me a Kiwi. I mean, for me,
you're a Kiwi here.
I was born there.
Right. But there, maybe not.
I had citizenship there up until I just got my American citizenship like last year. So I've been a citizen of New Zealand only for most of my life. But yeah.
But you left when you were how old?
When I was 3. But then we would visit every other year for summer vacation. But which kind of sucked because in New Zealand, if it was summer here, it would be winter there. So my year would be winter, spring, winter, fall every other year. And then every other year after that would be a normal year.
Did you spend the whole summer there?
Well, 10 weeks. Because once you pay all that money to go there, you want to stay there as long as possible to make value for dollar.
And was it inevitable that you were going to be somewhere cool? Because it was winter, because it was pretty hard to avoid?
We spent most of our time in Auckland, and Auckland, it rained every day.
Yeah.
So, yeah, a big part of my memory of being in New Zealand is sitting on my grandma's couch watching the rain and then drinking tea.
Right, that's okay. Despite the cold factor, there was something definitely sentimental about the whole thing.
Oh, I love New Zealand, yeah. And
did you think about going back in either 2000 or 2004?
In 2004.
Yeah, that was when Bush got reelected, and a lot of people
yeah.
were
like going to leave the country.
Yeah,
I think about going back all the time. I mean, the last time I was there was August. So
wow,
I brought.
So you still go back fairly often?
As much as I can.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, and the time before that was 2009, so it's not like every other year anymore, but...
Right, yeah. But it's just like you're not going back for the same reason that other expats aren't going back. You just said that you have thought about going back many times.
I don't go back because it's just hard to make space in my life to go back.
No, I mean... Weren't you saying permanently?
No, I don't think about going back to live there. I mean, I might fantasize about it, but
right.
I really feel like my life is here.
Got it. Okay. And where was most of your life after you moved out of New Zealand?
Grew up in Santa Monica and went to, at 18, went to New York to go to art school, stayed there for 4 more years, and then moved back here after I had decided I wanted to be an artist. And then went back to New York for grad school and then came back.
Okay.
So.
So I was looking at the work that you had in the show Eden's Edge that was at the Hammer, and the piece that I seem to remember most, and I couldn't find it actually on the web, maybe it's elsewhere, but you have these interlocking ceramic pieces, you call them dream catchers, among other work things, and I seem, the one that I remember is a version of that with beer cans, with the Sapporo beer cans. So that, in fact, was a piece.
Yes, I did a series of beer can sculptures, and the commonality between those and then the dream catchers was that it's still a gnarled and knotted form that has lots of holes. So I was kind of, it's a different material, but it, an echoing form. And but the beer cans do loom large. And I think because I'm working with abstract form, but when I use things that are readily available in our lives, or things that we are really familiar with, and they're kind of like hooks for the work. So it's this thing that hooks you in, or lets you in even, because it's familiar, and then I can take you to a really crazy place with my work. And you'll go because you're like, okay, it's a beer can. So
you hooked me, yeah. Yeah. Clearly, you hooked me, and that my memory just like latched onto like there's no tomorrow. But you didn't drink the beer in those cans.
Yes,
you did.
Well, I had beer parties.
Oh, okay. No, I meant you personally. You drank them all.
I drank them collectively with other people.
Okay, so you're okay.
I didn't
with
drink
beer
alone.
As long as it's Japanese.
I think I drank enough beer to not really have to drink that much beer anymore.
Right. How many of the sculptures with the beer cans have you made?
I think it was about 5 or 6, but it could be more. There's some half-made ones in my storage space. It's work that I've revisited a couple times, and it's not like I'm never going to use beer cans again, but I haven't used them in a while.
Right, right. Has that been it sounds like you're very aware of this hook element, but now that I mention this hook that I had, has that been something that you've used in your approach to your work, you know, over the years? You know, like, if I take this step, you know, I'm going to lure them in, but, you know, or whatever, that kind of dynamic in your head.
I think I'm always working with familiarity and then unfamiliarity at the same time. So even with those ceramic kind of gnarled forms, the hook with those was the name, which I was calling them dream catchers if they were hanging, and then if they were on pedestals or on tables, they were scholar rocks. So you know, people are familiar with what a dream catcher or a scholar rock is, usually. So that's kind of the thing that leads you in, and then you see it, and you might say, that's not a scholar rock, or that's not a dream catcher, but yes, it is, or, you know, it's a conversation starter.
Right. Well, that makes me... Those pieces make me think about the ceramic element and the ceramics element, which is something that I don't know how conscious you've been of kind of diverting that niche or that ghetto, but I mean, how much of a strategy, you know, of sort of not being a ceramicist is something that you've addressed or thought about?
Now I think about it quite a lot because ceramics is kind of getting its second wave or something. You know, ceramics is appearing a lot in contemporary galleries and in contemporary dialogue around art. But when I went to art school in the late 90s, it wasn't a material that I ever saw in galleries. So I kind of hid or buried the fact that I worked in clay. And
did
worked
you
in
bury
other
it
things.
Literally with things like denim?
When I was in undergrad, I can't say that I had yet made a commitment to denim. I was doing other things. So,
but were you in a ceramics department, or were you just a sculptor?
I was making sculpture. Okay. But in undergrad, I mean, I decided on sculpture 3/4 of the way in. So, I mean, undergrad, everything is up in the air. It was up in the air for me, but because when I went to when I got into art school, I thought that that I would just be working on the nude. I mean, I had to learn about contemporary art in general. I thought that the best artist, the zenith of art, was Rodin. So I had a lot of catching up to do. Mm. But New York was an amazing place to do that, because you can just go out, you just step outside your apartment, and then you see 20 gallery shows in 2 hours.
Right.
So I saw so much art that they were calling me gallery girl.
Hmm.
So I caught up, but while I was looking at stuff and learning about art that was made now as opposed to in the 19th century, I didn't see very much ceramics. So when I finally got the opportunity to work in ceramics again after art school, when I was invited to go to Mexico, to Guadalajara, to a ceramics factory to just do some work. And it was like freedom. It's the opposite of the ghetto. Because I thought, what I'm doing right now is not art, because I'm doing it in clay. I'm just going to do whatever I want to do. And for the first few years after art school working in ceramics, it felt like freedom. And I wasn't ever really trained in using clay. I didn't go to Alfred, which is, you know, one of the best schools for ceramics. I don't know how to throw on the wheel. So I've always kind of like misused the material or used it for my own ends. So it really can be this like freedom for me.
But I think the overall point is that you are, you know, as you were when you were making ceramics initially in school and kind of embarrassed about it. Now I'm not trying to make a connection to you being embarrassed about it, but you are just using it as one tool, as it were, in your, you know, or one material in your, you know, hybrid or gathering of materials.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And during school, I was more often not working in ceramics than working in ceramics, especially undergrad. I didn't do it at all.
Right.
So
you have this show now, Home Office. Is that the title?
Mm-hmm.
The short title anyway? I want to address it kind of from more of a macroscopic, kind of from an overall perspective, from a vernacular street level perspective. And that is part of your goal or intention to show some love to the people who maybe struggle with the challenge of being sort of a little too much in their home, you know, because they're working there and they're living there and, you know, they maybe need to get out a little bit and, you know, that whole kind of thing?
I'm definitely thinking about a certain lifestyle. And I think it depends on what your mood is, if you feel like it's like an envious lifestyle or not. But I mean, I think a lot of people have this lifestyle. Like, what does a screenwriter do? Or a lot of creative people, or what do graphic designers do? A lot of people work at home or work out of their homes. And I think in general, the lines are blurring between what's a work hour, what's a leisure hour, because you can take, people have company cell phones and they're getting calls at 9:30 at night. They're answering work calls. They're in their PJs. You know, it's like, it's all a mush right now.
Yeah, is it a mush for you?
Definitely.
Are you taking work calls late at night? What are,
I try
give
not
us some
to.
Of the, some of the dirty details of your home office life.
Well, one secret that it's obviously not going to be a secret anymore is that I will, if I am up really late at night and I am answering an email, I will not hit send if it's 3 a.m. I will hit send the next morning so that it doesn't look like I was answering calls or emails at 3 a.m. Because I actually don't want to be answering work emails at 3 a.m.
Right. But sometimes you are, just because you're up and whatever.
And I feel that this kind of work is continuous. I don't know, working in ideas or just correspondence. It's like always, there's always more. So you could, there's plenty to do. So
it sounds like it's very pleasant correspondence, though, if you're doing it that late. Otherwise, you know, my thing is that I try not to do any email, you know, after 9 or even 10 or 10 or even 9, because if it's the slightest bit stressful, you know, I don't want that, you know, coming into my dreams.
I know what you're saying, but if you have an insomnia problem and you're like, there's an email you're avoiding, you could also just get it over with.
Yeah.
I was saying it's the creative person's life, but I think we shouldn't feel so special, because I think it's increasingly everybody's life.
Well, you know, it brings to mind the recent Yahoo kerfuffle about, you know, the CEO who decided that people could no longer commute, you know, employees could no longer commute. They had telecommute. They had to work in
house. Actually be present.
Exactly. And so, I mean, I think by far, if you know, if you ask, take a poll, you'd find that most people are happy to have the working at home thing. But I guess you're drawing attention to, among other things, the downside to that. Or maybe you're just, I don't know, maybe you're just objectively sort of showing it for whatever it is, and people bring their own biases to it.
I think I am raising it up above my head for discussion, because I think there's good parts and I think there's bad parts. Like the other side of that coin of being in the era of telecommuting is that, when is your vacation time? Because my husband has a corporate job, and there's 5 weeks of 5 weeks of time per year, and it's vacation days, sick days, and holidays all mixed up into one. So when you're taking a day, it doesn't matter what it is. But because it doesn't matter what it is, it's an unspecified day, it doesn't feel like he will take a work call even if we're on a vacation. You know, there's just like, if it's important enough.
What kind of corporation does he work for?
I don't think I should say that part. But it's a corporate job.
Got it.
So it's not maybe it's not considered to be a
so
creative
you
job.
You are regularly party to this 24-hour kind of communication through him, if not through yourself.
Through both. I think that together we represent a range of professions, and we share a lifestyle, even though our professions are so different.
You share the 24-hour lifestyle.
We have this perspective. He's a good sleeper. So he's not. I'm the one that's answering the emails at 3 a.m.
How long have you had this insomnia problem?
Let's see. As long as I can remember.
Okay. So it's the normal.
Perhaps. But I didn't always email during it. So that part's
new. At what
new.
Point did you start?
Probably as soon as I was able to, when email was invented.
Well, I mean, there was this long period where email, you know, was around, but very few people were actually using it, you know,
right.
Like in the mid-90s or whatever it was. And then all of a sudden around 99, 2000, we all started, you know, and now it's like with the phones, I don't know if you're that kind of person where you're always texting and what have you.
Well, I am actually the Wicked Witch of the West in my college class that I teach, because a lot of college students now take notes for their class on their laptops, or that's what they say they're doing anyways, and I actually have no idea what they're doing, or I sometimes do know that they're not taking notes because it just looks, I can tell from their eyes and from how they're hiding.
They're having way too much fun. Yeah.
They're on Facebook.
Yeah.
Or whatever
they're
the teenager version of Facebook is.
Right.
So,
no, that's their version too, but they're probably IMing, I would imagine.
So, there's a no cell phone, no laptop rule in my classroom, and also notes are taken with paper and pen. So, I'm fighting against it in the classroom.
Can you practice what you preach? That was the question.
I am not constantly texting. Yeah.
That's a half-assed kind of response.
Well, everybody's in love with their iPhone. If you had to say, really?
I use it only for podcasting.
Ah.
That's it.
That's pretty good.
I'm impressed. It's not connected.
Well, that's good.
But I'm a little bit of a Luddite in a lot of ways, so I'm obviously not, you know... Yeah, I'm sure what you're talking about is the norm, for sure.
I always considered myself a Luddite. So, and if I the Luddite, am texting a lot, then...
So, what is your experience with your artist colleagues as far as how plugged in they are or not? Or less plugged in?
I think that... I actually can't give a simple answer for that, because I think people have different working styles. But I also think that these methods of communication are so easy and so approachable that it's hard to not be doing it. And I was just having a phone conversation with a collaborator today, and we were talking about how it just seems like there's more and more emails in the inbox that definitely need to be answered today. And so you potentially could sit at your desk answering emails and be, quote, productive for 4 hours a day. But then what are you really doing with your time? I mean, you are making dates, organizing your life, writing down thoughts, but like, what about actual time in the studio? Or,
yeah.
I mean, is it thinking? Are we thinking when we're like, what kind of thinking is that when we're working on those emails?
No, it's just busy work most of the time, isn't it?
It's weird because it feels so pressing when you're doing it.
But now with a little perspective, you realize that...
Well, why don't we talk about how you and I figured out this time to have this conversation. How many emails do you think we sent each other?
Okay. Thank you for bringing that up. well, I can almost count virtually how many, because, you know, in Gmail, which is the way that... I don't know if... Are you in Gmail too?
Yeah.
So I'm looking at this a few different... rows, and you know, it has in parentheses how many exchanges there have been, but on the other hand, they've all, you know, been 15 to 20 second, you know, emails. So
that's
in the
scheme
of things, I think we've spent, maybe not including our phone call, maybe 15-20 minutes total. I don't know, something like that.
It's interesting though, because it's in these funny little bits, like it might be over 15-20 emails.
Psychologically is the question, how much time that is.
Yeah.
Because
Because in actual email time, whether it's 10 seconds or 2 minutes, psychological time, it could be, you know, 5 minutes or 2 hours, right?
Well, if it took us like 2 weeks to come to a date and time and a place, or longer, because I think we started emailing a few weeks ago, it begins to loom large, this date we're making to have this conversation. And before there was email, how would we have done it?
Yeah. Well, we would have had a phone exchange. We would have called, left the message, you know, either
right.
a paper message or an answering machine
voicemail.
Message, or a voicemail. Right, right. Yeah, now what's your... I mean, I hope people don't mind how we're sort of diverging into this, but I am curious, what's your attitude towards the voicemail? Because I recently heard this, you know, there was probably a written version, and then there was an NPR version about, like, the death of the voicemail. What is your approach to the phone? I mean, some people now, obviously the kids, but I mean, even, like, the young to slightly older than young adults are like, oh, you know, what are you doing?
Never
calling
use
me.
It. Yeah. Yeah.
What's your sort of thing about that?
If it's someone that I am not friends with, I will email them and ask if there's a time that's best for me to call, if I'm not sure.
Yeah.
And then if someone's calling me that I need to avoid, or I'm not sure why they're calling me, or they're not my friend, at this point, I feel like picking up the phone is totally optional.
Right.
But answering your cell phone.
I think the question then is really, what is your dynamic with the friends that where it's okay to talk? I mean, is that something you engage in regularly, or is it more like a just infrequent kind of thing?
I think I feel nostalgic about those days when I had two-hour phone conversations with people. And I think that's one, aging, and two, being in 2013.
Yeah.
Because I don't have time now. But also, I don't think people communicate that way unless they're old.
Can we just, you know, have a little love fest for a moment for the days that we did have, like, you know, multiple hour phone conversations with people? I mean, I've only done that a couple times as an adult, but I definitely as a teenager did that a few times.
It's a beautiful thing.
Well, I don't know. I don't know how far, if we've gotten too far from the home office thing.
I don't think so.
Okay, good, good, good. What are some private things that you would like to talk about that we haven't covered yet?
That's a ridiculous question.
Yeah, but I'll frame it this way. My sense is that I can't figure out whether you have a very left brain kind of thing going on, or if you're just very sort of not necessarily shy, but kind of I don't know what the, I thought of the right
evasive?
Word earlier, but reserved.
Reserved. I mean, I love people, and I'm pretty social.
Okay,
and
so you're not an introvert.
I like entertaining.
You're not an introvert. Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
but I might have like an exterior of reserve, and that is because I was raised by Commonwealth parents. So if you are a mixture of, I mean, my parents are Chinese, so they're kind of have these traditional Chinese values, which is really about centering your energy towards the family, and for them it was really about centering their energy towards the family and not towards people you don't know or friends. And then just being Commonwealth, I can talk about the weather for 5 hours if you want me to.
So that's the English.
So maybe that's what,
the English decorum that runs through New Zealand life as well. That's what you're saying.
We sang when I went to school when I was in New Zealand during those summer vacations where I was not at the beach because I was in the winter time in New Zealand. We sang "God Save the Queen." Still, I'm not sure if they do that now.
Well, what kind of occasions did you sing that song?
Well, like summer? You have to do Pledge of Allegiance.
You were going to school while you're there.
Well, because it was winter,
So I didn't always go to school, but once my mother was like, you're sitting on the couch so long, why don't you just go to school? I was like, oh God, this is getting bad from bad to worse.
How did you feel sitting there, you know, having presumably sung the Pledge of Allegiance, singing God Save the Queen?
Well, it wasn't necessarily a worry about like, oh my goodness, now I am, I didn't believe in what I was singing either way, God Save the Queen or Pledge of Allegiance to the Flag. It basically is the same. It's just like I am in an institution and I am singing the like group song.
Right.
But it, I mean, I remember being sent to school in fifth grade. It's just called something else in New Zealand. Maybe it's like fourth form or something. And it was really uncomfortable, actually, because I was in Dunedin, which is a pretty small town in the South Island, and I was basically read to be an American, which I had an American accent. I went to American school, so it's just that New Zealand is so small and they're so far away. So everybody was like, who is this American person in school? And I stuck out like a sore thumb. Plus, everybody was in uniform and I didn't have a uniform. So I was walking around in my normal clothes.
Oh, really?
And
they let you get away with that because you were on vacation?
I had to go for 2 weeks. It was over 20 years ago, so my memory is pretty faint, but it wasn't fun. It was very interesting.
Well, psychologically, what did that outcast sort of dynamic do for you? Or do you not see it that way?
An outcast dynamic. Well, I don't, can you really be an outcast if you're only an outcast for 2 weeks? I guess you can.
Depends on how sensitive you are.
Right.
So I think one thing that we should probably talk about is the fact that I haven't seen, and others in LA haven't really seen much of your work since about 08, you know, which is fine. But do you see that? I mean, is from your perspective, have you been busy that whole time, or has there been kind of a little bit of, you know, low radar, low profile kind of thing going on?
I definitely have been busy this whole time. My last one-person shows, though, have not been in LA. So this is my first home office. Is my first LA solo show in 5 years. So that's why you haven't seen my work. I had a one-person show in San Francisco in 2012 called Tissues and Trench Coats. And that's where the trench coat pieces that you see in this show were begun for that show.
Okay.
And I paired them with these tissue dispensing sculptures, which with those I was trying to ride the knife edge between functional object and sculpture, really basically try to make it as sculptural as possible, sculpture looking as possible, but let it actually be a tissue dispensing object.
And how would you describe the trench coats in that sense?
And then the trench coats were this other body of work that I wasn't sure how it was connected. So what's a trench coat? Like as people have come to my studio, they've had different responses to seeing those things. And now they're starting to look less and less like immediately like trench coats. But once you know it's a trench coat, people are like, oh, that reminds me of growing up in New England and being on the subway in the morning and seeing all the dads go to work. Or, oh, that reminds me of a flasher. Oh, the trench coat is like the piece is one of the standard pieces that every woman should have in her wardrobe. So it's like,
where did you get the trench coats?
The trench coats are all, most of them are from the thrift store. I think it is an item that has been brought back by fashion magazines, but was actually more ubiquitous in the 80s. Because the trench coats that I'm finding in the thrift store are kind of from that time. And then now we have Burberry is back with, like, beautiful trench coats that everybody wants.
At least people who wear trench coats.
But then the trench
coat... Do you ever see... Because you made me planted this thought in my head when you were talking about function. Do you ever see... And we were also talking about Comme des Garçons before we went on the mic. Do you ever feel like these deconstructions of trench coats could then in turn be turned into high fashion?
That was something that I was talking about with a curator, and she was kind of thinking of fashion as, like, avant-garde fashion as a place where... if sculpture sort of has expressed all the aggressions that modern life takes on the body, like if you think about Gutai movement, this kind of Japanese post-war art movement where it's kind of about destruction or dissolution, it's really violence on the body, or the Viennese actionists as well. Mm-hmm. Art is reflecting a general feeling around the body. Fashion then maps it back onto the body. So if you look at Comme des Garçons' tumor clothing from 1997, it's like basically stretch fabric with giant tumors on the back, on the hip, and it's sort of about a fear of disease, and or it's like playing with those ideas.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to say what it's about.
So what are your trench coats playing with?
The trench coats, well, the process of making those is basically something I do with clothes. I've done it with jeans, and now with the trench coats, is just removing all the panels of fabric and leaving the seams. So what you're seeing with those trench coat pieces is just the seams of one trench coat inside another trench coat with this show. And there's just that many seams in a trench coat because a trench coat is such a complicated piece of... complicated garment. It has the lining, it has the pockets, it has the collar, the epaulettes, and once you start cutting it all away, you really begin to understand the actual object and how it's made. So for me, cutting the fabric away was really like an uncovering of the thing, or like, you know, revealing the thing. But that's just my process. Once you see it presented on the wall, I think it's again something. It becomes something else. I mean, it's like a 3D drawing of the thing. It's like this floppy drawing. They look like ghosts.
Mm-hmm.
They're weirdly symmetrical yet chaotic.
Has in the conversation you had, or with that curator, or with anyone else, was there the inclination to sew them together in such a way that they could be worn?
No, because they already are things that you would wear. I mean,
you're being very left-brained right now.
You're being very right-brained.
No, I mean it's completely logical. I'm not sure why you're not getting it. If you've deconstructed these trench coats and put them all together, and they're hanging, you know, you can use a million metaphors, like skeletons, like, you know, whatever, anything else. If you can somehow bring them into some kind of cohesion, And then they could be worn in an avant-garde haute couture sort of way.
I think that they could already be worn in the state that they are.
They would stay on? They wouldn't just flop down to... Because are they sewn together or not?
Well, I didn't unsew them. They started as objects that were sewn.
But there's seams from several different coats, correct?
There's... Each piece mm-hmm. has one trench coat inside another. If you take one... If you pick up one of the seams, you'll find that it's connected to another, to another, to another, to another. So I never cut any of the seams off. I just took out the panels of fabric. So it's still a continuous object.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm saying?
The part that I'm not understanding is, isn't it several different coats?
There's one trench coat inside another.
Oh, okay. But how did the...
So it's just like I did the same thing to two trench coats, and I just layered one on top of the other.
Uh-huh.
And that's something that is new, that is different from the show I had in 2012 in San Francisco. The show in 2012 in San Francisco was one trench coat. And with that, the difference there is that with one trench coat, it really does exist as a floppy drawing of the object. It's more readable mm-hmm. as a trench coat. And I kind of was thinking about it as a difference between painting and drawing. Here, there's the layering, and it makes it more complex, and then there's like this color play because the two trench coats are of different colors.
Right.
So in effect, you have four colors because the lining is one color, the outer shell is another color, and then the lining from the second trench coat, and then the outer shell from the second trench coat. So that's four colors.
Right, right, right. Okay. So I guess the question is whether anybody's going to wear it.
Avant-garde fashion, I mean, I don't think these are fashion. These are sculptures that address ideas of the body and wearing things. And avant-garde fashion, you could wear it. I mean, I don't intend these things to be worn, but I think that if somebody did this as a designer, like, that would be totally valid. I don't think you would have to do anything else to it. It's could still be a garment. Someone has tried them on. Rebecca Morris, in fact, tried on the jean seams.
Nice. Well, we come full circle then, don't we? We were talking about Rebecca Morris, believe it or not, before we started this whole conversation. That's just an aside to the listeners. Well, I guess we pretty much covered everything on the outside, didn't we?
I guess so.
Thanks, Anna.
Okay. Thanks, Michael.
And we're out.